How many of us have forgotten? Or perhaps even more tellingly, how many of us didn't necessarily appreciate the intensity of the Balkans War? Now, there have been many before and there have been many since. We look at Yemen today. But 20 years ago, when we were in Australia, mostly thinking about perhaps the Sydney Olympics coming soon, David Bridges was somewhere else. Tell me where you were 20 years ago, David.
20 years ago, I was the CIA's chief of station in Albania during the war in Kosovo. At the time, I had spent the previous 5 years working on the war in Bosnia primarily, and spending a lot of time looking at the steady infiltration of Arab fighters trained in Afghanistan into the Balkans.
I used terms at the beginning, David, about the mess, the massive number of known unknowns. Do you think, as an amateur compared to the professionals, I'm overstating a perspective that there's a huge number of known unknowns, perhaps compared with other times, and that in a sense, the messiness that was epitomized by the Balkans Wars is conceptually the same as the mess of lots of things going on at the moment. Am I fair in my characterization?
I'd agree with that. I would say, in fact, the number of known unknowns is escalating. We're living through the most revolutionary period in human history. The year I was born, the population of the Earth was 2.5 billion. 2 years ago, it was 7.9 billion. It's that growth, that explosive growth, is breaking down institutions. It's placing tremendous wear on cultures, on societies, on mores, and we have no replacement in sight, particularly for those institutions we've stood up since the end of the Second World War to mediate conflict. So I would argue, actually, that the number of unknown or known unknowns is set to grow enormously in the years ahead.
You had a saying that you couched, not specifically for me, but you had a saying that you couched that you took away in many respects from perhaps the initial number of years with the agency. Share that saying with the rest.
Speaking truth to power. So my job as an agency officer, I was in the clandestine service, the espionage cadre, and at the time of my retirement from CIA, I was a member of the senior leadership team. Throughout the entirety of my 25-year career, though, with CIA, what I was taught and what I learned was the fundamental importance of speaking truth to power. Now, speaking truth to power is something easy to say and hard to do, because you can find yourself frequently in situations where you're dealing with a superior, in my case, very senior members of the administration, including the president himself, who did not want to hear what I had to say because the facts I had collected were not congenial to the worldview he had formed. So, you know, it was a challenge for me. I was brought in to speak to Bill Clinton at one point, to present a series of facts that Bill Clinton clearly did not want to hear. Bill Clinton is a big man, and I am not. Bill Clinton stood over me, and I thought to myself it would be very easy to fold here, to say, Mr. President, you're right, I'm wrong, forgive me for wasting your time, and scuttle out of the Oval Office. But I'm ornery, and I thought, to hell with that. And I spoke truth to power. He didn't like what I had to say, but as the years go on, I'm deeply glad I did. I would have taken no pride in pulling my punches.
I'd like to turn now to a particular topic for us to have a conversation about, and that is U.S.-China relationships. At this program a year ago, I doubt that anybody would have made the case that there would be the kind of specific and provocative trade war interplay between the U.S. and China. Would you like to give us some context for how you see and how the minds of the agency would be seeing the interplay between the U.S. and China?
Sure. We've entered a new era. Whatever momentary results the current trade talks produce will be ephemeral. We've entered a new era that's going to be characterized by brief moments of detente interspersed with long periods of conflict. This is a secular change. There's not going to be a going back, a return to the way things were before. Those days are gone. You can stick a fork in them. The United States belatedly realized that China's aspirations for itself clashed directly with the U.S.'s own view of its role in the world economy. This was, I think, brought home to policymakers in Washington when China rolled out its Made in China 2025 initiative. The U.S. administration at the senior levels hadn't been paying as much attention and suddenly realized that China was preparing to make a gambit, make a play to occupy that space at the top of the economic development ladder. And that has alarmed U.S. policymakers in a way that they haven't been alarmed in years. What we're seeing now is the deliberate efforts by the U.S. administration to throw sand in China's economic gears by way of creating difficulties for party leadership, by way of compelling the party to shift its focus from achieving its very ambitious global agenda to addressing domestic discontent. Because the U.S. administration understands that at the heart of China is the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party is based on that Leninist construct of the revolutionary vanguard, a self-appointed elite accountable only to itself, whose deliberations necessarily take place away from public view. And it's a construct which is constantly open to challenge by the Chinese people themselves, who question its legitimacy to rule. If the U.S. administration can slow China's economic growth, it increases the chances that party leadership will have to shift its focus, like I say, from a global agenda to addressing domestic discontent. And we're going to be seeing that play out not just over the weeks and months, but over the years ahead.
Let's just insert for a moment your engagement now a number of years ago, I acknowledge, but as the executive director responsible for Russian CIA operations, do you get a sense that China is as concerning to the U.S. as Russia was or is or should be? What's the relative mix between the two?
Yeah, you know, my colleagues in Boston frequently ask me if we're entering a new Cold War with China, and I tell them that it is a grossly inappropriate phrase. The Cold War referred to a period in history when the United States and the Soviet Union contended for influence, for control, for domination on a world stage. And it was a clash of two political cultures. There was very little trade, though, between these two blocs. So the U.S. economic engagement with the Soviet Union, the Soviet economic engagement with the U.S. was very limited. China and the U.S. have a deeply symbiotic economic relationship. They are contending on a global stage for influence, for power, but they're doing it against the backdrop of these deeply intertwined economies, which means that the new conflict is going to be vastly more complex than the Cold War ever was. And it's going to play out, as I said, over years. We're just at the very beginning. This is the opening act.
Let's turn for a moment then in the context of US, China, and Australia, which is kind of like the love child of the US and China. It's, mm-hmm. it's betwixt and between. And think about the South China Sea issues, and think about the pressure responsibilities that are pushed from the US to Australia and from China to Australia. Some comments about that interplay with Australia, US, China.
Well, I put it to you that Australia faces the challenge of navigating a difficult course in the years ahead, maintaining its very close political and military alliance with the United States while maintaining positive economic engagement with China at a time when both China and the U.S. would really like Australia to forswear the other and sort of pledge its troth exclusively in one direction. Now, that's not going to happen, we understand, but it's going to be difficult. It's going to take or place a premium on wise decision-making. Now, what makes me very optimistic about Australia's chances of doing that is the fact that Australia is part of the Five Eyes Alliance, this remarkable structure that was set up at the end of the Second World War. The U.S., the U.K., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand are joined together in this global intelligence collection and intelligence sharing mechanism, which is, guarantees that the leaders of these five states have sustained access to the very best intelligence in the world. The Prime Minister of New Zealand, Mr. Morrison, Mr. Trudeau, Mrs. May, and Mr. Trump are hands down the best informed leaders in the world on the challenges that are coming down the pike. Not just the ones that are coming down the pike next week, but the ones that are coming down the pike next year and 5 years hence. That means that these five leaders uniquely in the world have the time and space necessary to begin to consider policies necessary to deal with these future challenges. Mrs. Ardern has better information than Xi in China or Putin in Russia. It's a remarkable construct, the Five Eyes Alliance, and it is very robust. I mean, at a time when my own country, for the first time in my life, has become a major contributor to global geopolitical volatility. That's what happens when you elect somebody who's grossly unsuited for the position he occupies. You know, it's nice to know that there are some things that won't change, and the Five Eyes Alliance is a very important one of those.
How do you characterize the risks that the U.S. Body politic and U.S. community, without knowing, is exposed to as a consequence of the current administration? Is it true to say that the checks and balances in the administration are sufficient to contain excessive risk, or are there other issues that the likes of the CIA and the likes of the FBI ought reasonably be concerned with, as we've seen reported recently?
Well, I mean, you know, I think the checks and balances that the founding fathers of the United States brought into existence are certainly being challenged by Mr. Trump, who is, by any standard, an outlier, whose inclinations fall outside the boundaries of what's normal American political behavior. That said, I believe that the legislative branch in the United States, U.S. Congress, the judicial branch, the courts, still are vibrant enough, dynamic enough, and have stiff enough spines to be able to act as effective checks on some of Mr. Trump's worst inclinations. But it's going to be a day-by-day, I don't want to call it a battle, we'll just call it a challenge, to be polite, that can last either two more years or six more years. You know, Mr. Trump is in the position he's in because the majority of my fellow citizens couldn't be bothered to vote on Election Day in 2016. Mr. Trump has played very carefully to that base that got him elected, and he continues to do so. He will continue to do so. We'll see if his shenanigans sufficiently energize the American voting public to produce a larger than normal turnout in 2020. I'm not convinced that will be the case, though.
In drawing this conversation to a conclusion, I'd like to turn to two aspects of your career around the Middle East. One is the peacekeeping roles that you played pre being part of the agency, and the other is the agency roles in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Is the Middle East just an irritant now with Trump saying Syria's dealt to, ISIS is dealt to, et cetera, et cetera? Or is this Iranian issue really a significant additional issue in geopolitics we ought to be materially concerned about?
I mean, I think the risks of conflict in the Middle East generally are higher now than they have been in recent memory. I don't see the possibility or the likelihood of state-on-state conflict as having grown substantially. The bigger risk is conflict triggered by clashes between sub-state actors, the Houthi rebels, you know, in Yemen, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, the Afghan Iranian militias operating in Syria, and you know their paymaster, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which has developed the capability to build proxies that operate across the Middle East that aim to foil, the geopolitical objectives of Sunni Arab states and the United States as well. The activities of the Revolutionary Guard proxies are alarming because they're baiting major states like Saudi Arabia into responding, into attempting a forceful military response, which they're not capable of sustaining. I mean, the very worst sort of war is the one you start that you can't win because you go in and you can't get out. Saudi Arabia, in point of fact, has a record of doing that. You know, today Saudi Arabia is embroiled in Yemen. At a time when Saudi public finances are under challenge, that entanglement is costing Saudi Arabia $100 million a day. They don't have an exit strategy. You know, what they're counting on is an ample supply of U.S. weapons, U.S. encouragement to get them out eventually, but it's not really a viable game plan. So you have the risk of states entangling sub-state actors without being able to escape, triggering broader conflict.
So let's finalize on this word risks that you've used a number of times just now. If you were to get together with some colleagues of past times from the agency, what would be the biggest risk you would argue we face?
So I actually do get together with my four old partners. One was a head of the service. The other three were, like me, seniors. We get together once a year to talk about what lies ahead, what we see as the principal risks. And in years past, there's been lively disagreement. But in the past 3 years, actually, we've agreed, there's been universal agreement, that the principal risk we all face is complacency. You know, I would say in the financial services industry, something I came to 7 years ago, the principal propulsive force is formed by a demographic tier between, we'll say, the ages of sort of mid-20s and mid-40s. That's a demographic that's lived through a period of exceptional peacefulness in human history. What I see in Boston with my younger colleagues is a tendency to draw straight-line projections based on their personal experience. Last year was okay. Last week was okay. Yesterday was okay. So tomorrow, next month, next year will probably be okay too. It's a subconscious straight-line projection, and it makes no provision for the possibility of crisis. Now, in my experience, what happens when complacency gets popped is it's followed in the immediate aftermath by extreme volatility. People go from reacting to nothing to reacting to everything. And that, I think, is the growing risk, is the simple complacency and the disruptive effects it will have when it is overturned by crisis.
There we go. So here's a man who was the operational head and command of all CIA offensive and defensive counterintelligence services worldwide, challenging us to get off our butts and avoid or get out of complacency. David told me in prepping that he has a pile of papers on his desk. He's there not as an investment specialist, but as an experienced analyst giving input to Fidelity Investments, and a pile that is headed, "I told you so." Those of you who know telling a portfolio manager, "I told you so," doesn't work too well, David Bridges gets away with it. Please say thank you very much to David Bridges.
Thank you.